Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Is college worth the time and the money anymore? How could we change it to enhance it, enhance the value of college to the typical student and, for that matter, the typical employer? Joining us today to talk about these issues is Richard Vetter. He teaches economics at Ohio University and is an adjunct scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and directs the Center for College Affordability. Professor Vetter has a PhD from the University of Illinois. I usually don't mention your education, Professor Vetter, but I figure it's relevant in this conversation.
Well, glad to be with you, Anne.
Welcome to the show. Also with us Luis Suarez. He's director of the post-secondary education program at the Center for American Progress. It's a progressive think tank that covers the gamut of issues affecting Americans. Luis holds a master's degree in public administration from Harvard University and a bachelor's degree in business economics from Brown University. Welcome to the show, Luis.
Great, Anne. Thanks to be with you.
Professor Vetter, how do you define a good deal in higher education these days?
Well, I don't know if exactly the answer to that question. I think there are a lot of good deals out there. For many people, a good deal is related to the income that they will earn after they graduate, as that compares to the cost of getting the education. Now, that's not true for everyone, but it's true for some people. And for a large proportion of the population, it's still a good deal to go to college, to get a degree, and to join the workforce. So for those people, it's a great ideal and a great goal to try to achieve. However, there are 45-50% of those people who enter college, a traditional four-year college, that fail to get a bachelor's degree within 6 years. And for many of those people, college is a distinctly bad deal. And there are other people who, for one reason or the other, lack the skills, the desire, the motivation, and maybe in some cases the financial resources to get a degree. So there are different strokes for different folks. Some people, college is a great deal. Other people, it isn't.
What do you think, Luis? How do you define a good deal in higher education these days?
Sure. Well, first, we need to take a step back, right, and realize that, you know, implicit kind of in your question and in Professor Vetter's answer was this idea that college is a baccalaureate degree and something where, you know, public policy is only starting to really look at now is that when we talk about education that happens after high school, we have to think of it as a continuum of education. I mean, most relevantly, it's perhaps about the work that happens in community colleges around associate's degrees and certificates and such, up through, you know, a bachelor's degree and beyond. And the skills that the economy needs range across all of those degree levels, or the connection between, you know what the skills we associate with a baccalaureate or the more technical skills with, for example, an applied an associate's degree. And so there's this continuum of what we might call college. And one of the things that we haven't done such a good job with over the years is really see it that way. And so when we're talking about what's a good value in education, I would agree with, you know, for Professor Vetter's kind of economic kind of construct about, you know, the return on investment versus the cost. But we also have to start thinking about, we have to move beyond just the baccalaureate as the only thing we're talking about, whether implicitly or explicitly, when we think of college.
Dr. Vetter, what about that? I mean, when you're going to college, is it just a degree that you're after, or is it something, there's something more intrinsic and less concrete than that?
Well, there is more than just a degree, but there are many motives and reasons people go to post-secondary education, onto post-secondary education, one of which is to get a degree and to with a goal of earning a good income after graduation. There are people that go to college in part for the socialization dimensions of college, particularly at residential colleges. And one reason may be that people take 5 or 6 years to get a degree is that some of them are having an awful lot of fun, and they're having a good time. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that, although one could question whether that should be part of the public agenda in terms of subsidization. I would agree with Mr. Suarez on the idea that post-secondary education does involve a lot more than just a four-year degree. I'm actually a great believer in associate degrees, and I think probably a larger percentage of high school graduates who go on should consider associate degree options, at least at first. And if they succeed in those options, they can always, of course, continue on into a four-year program. So the making education more seamless between the high school level, the associate degree level, and the higher education level is something I think nearly all educational reformers applaud, and certainly I do, and I suspect Mr. Suarez does as well.
There seems to be a tension between the for-profit and the not-for-profit higher education culture these days. Professor Vetter, you say that for-profit higher education costs less and disproportionately serves the low-income first-generation college crowd. I was wondering, when you're talking about for-profit in those terms, do you mean that it costs less relative to the average family income of the student, or that it's relative to the competition in the not-for-profit education sector?
Well, when I say cost less, I'm not looking necessarily at the cost to the student, the amount of checks the student writes, and rather I'm looking at the cost to society, the total amount of resources spent, say, per student associated with any amount of education. Now, one reason, of course, the costs sometimes turn out to be less is that these schools are not engaged in research and other activities. I'm not necessarily saying they're better schools or worse schools, but I do think they are an important option. As to their disproportionately serving low-income students, first-generation college students, minority groups and all, I think the statistical evidence is pretty clear on that point. They simply do serve a large percentage of people in those groups. They also tend to serve much, much more older Americans, non-traditional aged Americans, adult learners who have been maybe in the workplace for a few years and are returning to school in an attempt to better themselves. So they serve a somewhat different demographic on average than the traditional universities. It's not comparing apples and oranges completely because they are both in the education business, but there are some significant differences between the two types of institutions.
So do we need both?
I think so.
Lewis, for-profit seems more focused on vocational training. Do they seem like, are they apples and apples or apples and oranges to you when you compare the two different approaches?
Well, I think that, you know, in some ways the for-profit sector has been around for a long, long time. It's become more visible in the last, say, 15 to 20 years with the rise of some of the larger online schools and things like this. And when they really began around this notion of serving these non-traditional older students who, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you know, more traditional residential schools weren't serving very well. And so in some ways, it's a very natural thing that happens in an economy like ours that, you know, folks see, you know, a consumer that's not being tended to and they respond. Part of what's raised the visibility of them in our current policy dialogue is that as they have been serving lower income folks, you know, the percentage of, for example, Pell Grants that they get outstrips their percentage of the marketplace. So the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, has reports that, you know, suggest that, you know, the for-profits have about 10% of the total undergraduate student body, but they have 25% of Pell Grants, for example. And this raises a lot of issues if the education isn't of good quality and isn't yielding them a job afterwards that gives them an income that can help them service things like their loans. This is part of the flashpoint that for-profits have become. And I think one of the things that we need to do with public policy is make sure that where there are bad practices, we regulate them. But also realize that, you know, as this educational form that's really focused on vocational ed and these things, to the extent that there are things to be learned from that we should be, it's advisable for us to learn what we can about what works well in those institutions.
Dr. Vetter, you've said that I'm wondering if there's a connection here. You say that premier universities, and I'm not sure what you mean by premier, but I imagine Harvard falls into that. But premier universities have largely abandoned the first-generation college students. Is that why so many are going to the for-profit institutions? And how have those premier universities abandoned?
Well, if you look, you know, I think there's been some belated recognition in the last few years that in the quest of trying to get the best students based on merit criteria, that schools have found themselves with a demographic that they frankly should maybe somewhat uncomfortable with. You look at the percentage of students getting Pell Grants at the even at the best state universities, flagship universities, the University of Virginia, for example, fewer than 10% of students are on Pell Grants. The national average is much, much higher than that, closer to 30%. So we have found that some of the elite universities, and of course this includes some of the private ones too, some of the Ivy Leagues and all, have a rather low percentage of their students come from these types of schools because they're wanting students with high SAT scores, high school rank, who are likely to perform well in college, which is of course a perfectly normal and maybe admirable goal to pursue. But in doing that, they disproportionately reject students from these lower income backgrounds who probably have a less a solid educational background, went to less good high schools and so forth, maybe inner city schools rather than good suburban schools which have lots of advanced placement and so forth. So you have an issue there. Dr. Suarez, I made a good point, although I put a little different emphasis on it, I think. It is true that the for-profits have a disproportionate number of low-income students, and therefore low-income students come from backgrounds which inevitably there are going to be more problems. Many of them come, for example, from poor high school backgrounds and so forth. So you get a higher student loan default rate from these kind of students. You get quality issues raised. But the same thing is true at many public universities. The University of Texas at El Paso, only 4% of the students who go into a four-year degree program there get a degree in 4 years, 4%, 1 out of 25. Now, that's a public institution. So if we're going to look at the performance of schools, we ought to look at them across the board, both public and private and private for-profit.
Isn't the University of Texas El Paso a satellite operation, though, from the big university? Isn't it often the case that at those places that they're not necessarily going to school full-time, or are you talking about full-time?
Well, I think the full-time, that is a full-time statistic,
yes.
I recall.
Okay.
But it is true. It's a satellite operation, much like, say, the branch campuses of Ohio State
right.
University.
Okay.
Sure.
But It's a great question that you asked, Dan, though, about the full time versus part time, because it really begins to get at an issue that's a really broad issue, and I think that for profits are kind of because they are in the for profit business, they end up being at the tip of this conversation or the front end of it. For example, so in our federal data systems for gathering data about undergraduates, we only gather data on first-time, full-time students. And so we don't really have a good sense of the different issues and challenges that are facing part-time students who may transfer from around satellite campuses because their life requirements require them to start and then maybe stop because they have to work. And so we don't really have a good sense mm-hmm. of all the issues that surround the lives of these people, at least at the federal level. I think in practice, at some good institutions, they make it work. And so as the for-profits have become more visible and they have this population of low-income people and they do charge that higher market price, the outsized price based on the challenges of the students is surfacing first there. But it presents policy questions that we need to answer about, if someone isn't at a college reading level but they're out of high school, we just haven't done a good job historically in the U.S. of building a bridge for that person to be successful. And it is so it's crucial that we actually do that, and there are a lot of initiatives that are growing up, both in the current administration and in the philanthropic community, to work on those issues.
We have to take a short break. We're talking about college. Is it worth the time? Is it worth the money anymore? And how can we change it to make it better, more of a value to the typical student and the typical employer? Joining us today to talk about these issues is Richard Vedder, Ohio University professor, and also Luis Suarez, Director of Postsecondary Education Programs at the Center for American Progress. We will return in a few minutes. If you're a college student, if you're at OSU, for that matter, graduating this weekend maybe, what value do you place on your degree? Do you have a job? Are you going to graduate school? Maybe you're putting somebody through college. Value your opinion as well. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
See the new lineup of public affairs programming Friday nights from WOSU-TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group, and at 9:30 PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night beginning at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
67 degrees in downtown Columbus, showers and thunderstorms today, a high of 78, clouds tonight with a chance of rain, a low of 58, clearing up for Thursday with sunshine and a high of 82. And then partly sunny on Friday and a high of 87. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820. NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour, Richard Vedder. He's an Ohio University economics professor, and Luis Suarez. He's a director of postsecondary education programs for the Center for American Progress. We're talking about college. Is it still worth it? Or do the economic times beg us for different alternatives? Professor Vedder, you've criticized the leadership matrix at colleges and universities in the United States, particularly nonprofits, for maintaining low demand academic programs to please the faculty, and kind of that whole idea that the faculty can approve, you know, that the there's approval ratings that come from the faculty that can drive decisions like this. I was wondering about that low-demand academic program issue. Does it follow that if a curriculum is low-demand, that it's not relevant and then it's not important to have it?
Well, there are many, many things that we teach in universities that probably should be taught somewhere, and that we do have an obligation, I think, as universities to sort of – we're sort of the reservoir of information that has accumulated over the centuries and even the millennia in Western civilization, and we are sort of the people that further the continuance of that civilization and the expansion of it. So there are some things that we know about that we probably should continue to know about and maybe even should continue to teach on at least some scale somewhere. But it isn't necessarily true that every college should have programs in every subject. And there are limits on resources and limits on, frankly, good scholars that and good teachers that mean that sometimes schools try to overreach and offer programs that they really don't can't offer well, or that are extremely expensive to operate and are being maintained because there's a senior faculty member who is sticking around and is teaching those courses, who likes those courses, who wants to teach them, but gets relatively few students. I see this in my own world. My department that I'm in, I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but
you've probably gotten in trouble already.
Yeah, that's one of the virtues of tenure is you can get in trouble all the time and really not get in trouble. There are classes we offer with that occasionally will have 7 or 8 students. Then I will turn students away from my classes with 40 or 50 students. They're both teaching sort of specialized areas of advanced economics. I think you can make a case that both areas have some validity in the world. But sometimes we keep people away from getting the subjects that the students want, or the subjects that are growing in relative importance over time with changing conditions, simply because of the way universities are organized. We are organized on a medieval model. We have a system of shared governance that us faculty just love, but it's terribly inefficient. It's very hard to make decisions, very hard to change. It's very hard to push new programs through because of vested interests and so forth. So there are some problems with the governance in universities, which is one reason I kind of like the for-profit, having the for-profits around as part of the mix, is because they they're under a different governing model, and therefore they can move more nimbly and quickly to offer subjects that, say, students want.
Luis Suarez, do you think it's an either-or proposition?
In either-or?
When it comes to governance. Should it be profit motivated, or should it have that shared governance that's evolved over time?
Well, I approach the question a little bit differently. You know, mm-hmm. One of our biggest challenges in public policy right now is, as you know, societal and the economy's demands have been pushing us more towards skills that we associate, people needing skills that we associate with education after high school, post-secondary education, some level of college level skills or an equivalent. You know, there's been increasing enrollment in all colleges, but we haven't figured out really how to measure the outcomes. How do we know if someone learned something? You know, we have to remember that right now, we still, in terms of public dollars invested at the state level, for example, in a state land grant college, we pay based on enrollment. We don't pay based on whether or not they graduate people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the shared governance model probably could be better, but there's also a real question about, you know, if we're subsidizing this, have we reached a point where we have to better understand what we're getting for the public tax dollars that are going into the universities? And it's a very, very tough question. We're only beginning to wrestle with it since 1965 with the Higher Education Act that really created, you know, the original model for the Pell Grants and eventually opened up the market for subsidized student loans. We've been really focused on access in higher education and not so much what's called completion, which is something that we work at the center, and many organizations are working on now, and is a concern for the Obama administration, and I would argue increasingly at the state level for governors, and perhaps to a less extent the state legislatures. But once we have to begin to wrestle with that question, and you know, if we're putting this money in, if folks are enrolling but they're never finishing, you know, is that a wise expenditure of public dollars? One, and two. Okay, if we're going to begin to measure, what does completion mean to us? Is it just, you know, associate's degrees and bachelor's degrees, or are there other things that are important credentials that people will, you know, afford people the opportunity to get a good-paying job when they leave their school?
We're talking about college right now. Is it still worth the money? And how could we change it to make it more worthwhile to more people? Alex, you're on the air. You're a medical student at OSU, and you have an idea, or you know, you have a your undergraduate had a limited value.
Yeah. So one thing that I've heard fairly frequently is this idea that an undergraduate degree is mostly sort of a shibboleth for people who can, you know, stick to it for 4 years or whatever. And what I found after I graduated was that it was pretty much impossible for me to get a job anywhere in my field. And admittedly, biological sciences is one of those things where advanced degrees make you a lot more useful, but I found that I couldn't really do anything except go on to grad school or professional school. So.
What sort of jobs did you try to get?
These are things like lab tech jobs, or because you know how the governor and the previous governor were pushing the third frontier thing,
right?
Trying to bring in biotech and things like that. And there were a bunch of job fairs, and I showed up to them, brought resumes, and got zero responses.
See, I mean, is that because you didn't have an advanced degree? Or because I would imagine with my degree in journalism from Michigan State, you'd have a better chance of getting a lab tech job than I would. So who does get them?
A lot of people who end up with working tech jobs are, well, there are a lot of people who are doing postdocs. So these are people who already have PhDs but are working for essentially slave wages,
mm-hmm.
In order to get more publications or whatever. There are a lot of people with master's degrees who either didn't want to go on for PhDs or for whatever reason weren't able to complete PhDs.
Okay.
They end up taking a lot of tech jobs as well. And when I say tech, I mean technician jobs. These are people who are carrying out experiments, not just any job in the biotech sector.
So you were competing with people who had more advanced education.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that they don't tell you that going into at least the biotech programs at OSU is that if you're not prepared to go on for another 2 to 7 years, you're going to be unemployable.
Yeah. Well, that is a good question. Professor Vetter and Luis Suarez, that how well prepared not only are people to tackle the academics, but tackle the career choices that confront them.
I found Alex's call very interesting because I've been doing a number of these call-in shows over the last month or two, and his reaction is very, very similar to many others. There are some people that think we have something like diploma inflation in America, where it takes a master's degree now to be a lab technician, where you used to be able to do so with a bachelor's degree, or it maybe takes even a postdoc status to do it. That's carrying a little far. And you notice in the unemployment statistics that the unemployment rate now for people with bachelor's degrees in the United States is at the current rate is almost 5%. It is the highest unemployment rate recorded since they've kept that statistic for college grads. And where it used to be, college grads had very, very low unemployment rates, maybe a quarter of that of the general population. That's been creeping up, that ratio.
But it's still much lower than people without a college.
Yeah, it's still lower. There's no question about it. But a lot of people with college degrees who are trained in, say, the biological sciences are taking jobs in areas unrelated to anything they studied. Now, that isn't necessarily all bad, but it is points out a reality is that we in colleges set up all these programs and we turn out all these students, but sometimes there is a disconnect between what job markets are telling us that they want and what employers are telling us that they want and what the colleges are actually producing.
Luis Suarez, what do you think?
So, I mean, two or three observations. One is that one of the things that it's very challenging to do is to look at the way employers use something like a baccalaureate or a master's or a baccalaureate and some type of professional certification on top of that to measure a certain bundle of skills that they want. One of the things that's been happening over the last 30 years is that, you know, especially as we've had the disappearing of larger U.S. companies that had internal career ladders, especially for folks with baccalaureate degrees, is that before there was kind of a build-your-own mentality among large companies in the U.S. where you take someone who had a baccalaureate and you were willing to have them take 3 years as they went through either a formal or informal management pathway or skills pathway to get to the productivity that you wanted. And more employers want you to have what the equivalent of your baccalaureate with those years of experience right when you start. And so there's more like a buy the skills as opposed to a build the skills. And so that's some of what new college grads might be experiencing. But there's something else, too. We don't do a very good job with helping folks especially if it's a younger undergraduate or a younger person taking courses in college. They may be still figuring out what their interests are, what they may want to do. So that's one thing to take into consideration. But also, we don't do a very good job of helping folks understand while they're still in, you know, in the educational environment, what the labor market trends are out there, what the skills really are for the areas that they might be interested in, and kind of empower them with that consumer information. And this is something we do a lot of work on at the center. An anecdote that is actually interesting: about 3 years ago in Business Week, there was a story about how the hottest candidates that companies were looking for that year were people that had both MBAs and MFAs. And this was continuing today, there's a movement in the business world and the private sector around something they call design skills and creativity. And the idea was, for the businesses, they didn't have the time or the inclination to dig below, you know, to figure out what MBA skills you had and what fine arts creativity skills you had. They just looked at MBA, MFA, and they said, okay, if you have both of those, you probably have the mix of skills that I want. And so understanding what the skills are that folks actually want, understanding that while you're still pursuing your education, understanding the labor market trends, is something we don't really do a very good job of. You know, for example, in publicly funded community colleges, the average for a counselor of some kind to a student is like 1 to 1,500.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not really that robust way of helping folks understand the information, understand how their courses connect to what might be the situation out in the labor market afterwards. And we do need to do a much better job of that.
And what about that nimbleness factor that Professor Vetter brought up earlier, that even if you knew what the skill set was that you need, are the big universities, the traditional public universities, very nimble at responding to those requirements?
I think there's a problem there. This has been one of the more cordial conversations I've been in recently on this. I happen to agree with Mr. Suarez on almost everything, and particularly his comments about we really don't know what people are learning in college, which is part of the problem too. And employers don't know what they're learning in college exactly, and they know they have a degree, and that connotes a certain vague set of knowledge, but not a lot. I think there is a problem with the nimbleness because the labor markets are changing all the time, and colleges take a while to respond to this. Professors, like to teach on Mondays and Wednesdays from 10 to 2 p.m., and they don't want to teach in the evenings or on the weekends, and that's how some of the for-profit schools and some of the associate degree programs have grown in popularity, because they are more responsive to the needs of the consumers, and I also think to the needs of the labor market.
We have to take a short break right now, but I want to come back to that issue about responsiveness. OSU is getting ready to go to a semester system, and some folks think that that'll make it easier for part-time students to participate in that kind of college experience. We'll come back to that in a few minutes in our discussion about college. Is it still worth it for you? This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Joan Rivers. She just turned 77, and getting gigs isn't as easy as it used to be.
Age? It's the one mountain that you can't overcome. It's a youth society, and nobody wants you.
There's a new documentary about a year in her life called Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Be sure to watch Columbus on the Record on WOSU TV. Each week, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson talks with political analysts and news reporters about the top stories of the week. Watch Columbus on the Record, a part of the new public affairs programming lineup, Friday nights now at 8:30 on WOSU TV.
Support for WOSU comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
68 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40 this morning. Showers and thunderstorms today, a high of 78. Clouds tonight, a low of 58 degrees. Clearing up for Thursday, sunshine and a high of 82, and then partly sunny and warmer for Friday with a high of 87. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour, Luis Suarez. He is the Director of Postsecondary Education Programs at Center for American Progress, and also Professor Richard Vetter, economics professor at Ohio University. We're talking about the value of a college education and how it's changed over time, or how maybe it hasn't. From Eugenia on Facebook, we have this comment. I'm a University of Texas El Paso graduate. Just coincidentally, Professor Vetter, and I'm currently a professor at OSU. I do find some similarities, but there are great differences. I think of University of Texas El Paso as a commuter school, while OSU is definitely a more traditional college. I know many of our students work in that. Many University of Texas El Paso students are full-time students, but I think the way classes are structured and scheduled now at OSU do prevent more students who work full-time. What would the semester conversion make a difference? Would those kinds of things, Lewis, are those the kinds of things that colleges can do to change, to make themselves more, to be more available to non-traditional students and students with economic burdens?
Sure. I mean, as we're having more and more folks that are entering into undergraduate education that have to balance, you know, their studying responsibilities with work responsibilities and even family responsibilities. You know, we have to remember that over the last 30 years, the average age of a Pell Grant recipient has gone from the age of, I think, 19 to almost 24. So you're having an older group of students that are actually in some type of undergraduate education, and when they're balancing those issues, clearly there's a need for programming that's more flexible, not the traditional semester-based model that suits a residential student. And, you know, I think each institution has to look at, you know, its student population and the folks that are applying to figure out what that model is. But it's clear that we do need more flexibility in those instructional models. You know, the policy areas that we've been exploring and have been, you know, talking with the administration about is this notion of, you know, so for a lot of these older students, they need to earn money, you know, perhaps even full-time money while they're trying to get some type of post-secondary credential over time. And we've suggested looking at, well, you know what, let's merge in apprenticeships, which we've traditionally associated with labor unions, and, you know, associate degree education. So that way you can do your apprenticeship and through a combination of what you learn in the workplace and some courses you take, you end up with both your journeyman's license in the field and an associate's degree. And this is really kind of pushing the thinking of where we may need to go with higher education to better serve the needs of all the folks that we need to educate.
We have some calls and some emails, 614-292-8513, if you'd like to join the conversation. Ian, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for having me. My question really relates to the first caller. I'm a professional. I work full-time, and I've obtained an MBA. But my question really has to do with furthering my education would require, you know, a doctorate in, like, business administration. The only way I can achieve that, because I can't just give up my job. You know, I've been looking at online degrees and things like that. But my question has to do with the comparative value of or comparative quality of a for-profit education or for-profit degree, rather than from an institution like Ohio State.
So you mean getting a doctorate from online from a for-profit university,
right,
versus, and whether or not that'll enhance your chances in the job market?
Right. I mean, I'm curious to hear what your guests have to say on the subject.
Well, I think that's a very good and legitimate question. I don't really know the answer to that question. You pointed out the key problem that adult learners have, and it's actually a problem to some extent of traditional kids going to college. There is the biggest cost of going to college is the opportunity cost, that is, the work you have to give up to go to a residential school full-time, which is very, very expensive and prohibitively expensive for people who are breadwinners, who have families, and who actually earn pretty high income, so that those income losses are great. So the online option is an extremely attractive option. Now, whether the quality of the degrees earned is equal to, or better than, or less than traditional degree programs, I think is somewhat debatable. There is some research out, by the way, that the U.S. Department of Education has released, that shows that in many cases online training is actually qualitatively quite good and actually the equal of traditional schools. But if you ask me if getting a doctor's degree from a rather obscure for-profit school is equal to getting a doctorate at Harvard in business, I'd have to say probably not. But you have to weigh the costs and the benefits. And I just don't know I think it's an empirical question. What are the graduates of these programs getting in the way of employment? I don't know.
Okay, Ian, thanks for your call.
Thanks so much.
I would just add, Ian, to the conversation that, you know, these national averages, you know, about employment don't really get into, you know, individual institutional relationships in higher ed, whether it be in the public, the nonprofit, or even in the for-profit sectors, where you'll see, you know, you have, a given school, perhaps it's a community college that, you know, it doesn't have good graduation rates, but there may be one program like a registered nursing program that's actually quite good in that region. And it has good relationships with employers that lead to good outcomes. And right now, we just don't disaggregate that kind of information in any meaningful way. I mean, one of the real challenges for us in higher ed that we're beginning to work on is, number one, disaggregating that kind of data so that we know a little bit more about what the results of specific programs are within the schools. But then also, and this is happening a little bit with, we're beginning to see the development of something we in policy world call state longitudinal data systems. The Recovery Act had grant funds to states to really begin to be able to look at building data systems that allow you to connect, you know, a student's kind of like where they went to school so you understand what their educational background is with their labor market outcomes. And that, you know, that's a, you know, states, more and more states are at least starting to build those. The federal government just announced those grants, I think, last week or the week after, the week before. And so, you know, those kinds of data elements are going to begin to help us shape the policy picture that allows us to answer some of these questions. I want to come back to Ohio for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the things that Ohio actually has been a leader in for some time is in implementing legislation at the state level to pursue performance funding. And that essentially means where you start linking the state funds that higher ed institutions get, you know, the 4 years, research institutions, more teaching-oriented 4 years, and then their community colleges, and begin to link that to some of their performance outcomes in degree completion and courses. And, I think Ohio actually is one of the states to watch on this and to see how that works, how institutions respond. Do we get better outcomes and things like this? But it's always important to remember that we really, you know, over the last 30 years, I'm just repeating something I said earlier, but it for all of us that do this work, it bears this. You know, we mostly focused on access, which is so important. And what we need to do is continue our focus on access and helping make college, you know, affordable for folks, but also focusing on making sure that people finish college and succeed, because that's where they get the most payoff in terms of the labor market anyway.
Yeah, if I may pick up, I agree completely with Lewis on this, but of every 100 students that enter high school, if you look at those students 10 years later, only about 20 of them have actually completed a four-year college degree. Now, some of them drop out in high school, Some of them never make it into college. That's the access issue. But then there's the issue that Lewis is raising, and I'm quite agree with him on this. There's a huge attrition rate along the way, particularly even after they start college. And Ohio has improved its funding formulas to put a little more emphasis on, instead of giving money to universities based on just enrollment, but more on the basis of courses completed rather than based on the day you sign up for the course. And even some states are starting to give bonuses to universities that have high four-year graduation rates. Now, there's some problems with that, too. Great inflation, incentives increase, and so forth.
Right.
But the idea is a good one, and I think we need to get better measurement issues on what's going on in college, what the kids are learning, and why they're not getting through.
Professor Vetter, I suppose one of your more controversial assertions recently has been that you advocate ending public subsidies for higher education, turning it all back to the marketplace. And that's possibly an oversimplification, but I think I pulled that right out of one of your writings. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around the idea of taking public subsidies away from all higher education.
Well, I've said many things.
How would you even begin to do that?
Well, I've actually contradicted myself on that on other occasions. That's what academics can do.
That's what tenure's good for.
Yeah, it's amazing what tenure can do for. I do think we need to move to new ways of funding higher education and new ways of doing it. And within public sector, I'd like to see more of the money go directly to the students directly rather than to institutions and to give the students a little more, empower the students a little more, and therefore the universities become a little more interested in the students if the money is directly coming from the students rather than from, say, a governmental agency. It goes back to the big issue here is, is higher education a public good or is it a private good? And that is, do the benefits from higher education accrue mainly to the people that are getting the education, or do they accrue more generally to society in some broader sense? And I think that my own research leads me to believe that most of the benefits are really pretty purely private, and therefore it is legitimate to ask students to pay a large percentage of their education. There is a public dimension to this, and there's also the broader issue of access, equality of opportunity, and so forth. And I think we need to target our monies that we give to higher education to meet those egalitarian arguments a little more better, a little more intelligently. We have too much money goes to upper income kids to go to, dare I say, Ohio State or Ohio University. Too much money indirectly goes to those kids who could be paying for their own education.
You know, when you're talking about the larger society benefiting versus the individual, our last program was about developing the downtown in Columbus, and one of my guests makes his living assessing downtown viability, and one of the top criteria used to assess a viability of a downtown is having colleges and universities located downtown. Places like Columbus State Community or Columbus State, also, you know, the College of Art and Design, Columbus College of Art and Design, and that sort of thing downtown. I mean, isn't there a larger public good that way?
Well, this is an empirical question, I think. I've been doing research on what do people do with respect to college towns? Do they move into college towns or out of college towns? I'm not talking about college students. I'm talking about other people. In other words, is there sort of an ambience that universities create that's very, very favorable? I happen to think there is, because I have the tastes and preferences of the kind of people that go to college. I went to college 52 years ago, and I said, this is cool, and I've never left. I'm still there. But there, the evidence isn't altogether clear on that point. I'm a statistician. I look at the evidence. Do states that give a lot of money to higher education get a huge inflow of folks who want to have part of the good life, the high quality life of the kind of state. The evidence is pretty mixed on it.
Do you agree, Lewis?
In the spirit of disagreeing with Dr.
Yeah, we ought to have.
All right, let's duke it out now.
We haven't disagreed much today.
I believe there's ample evidence on the social benefits, from increased citizen participation to healthcare outcomes for folks that are more educated. So on that score, there. I believe there's, you know, ample evidence that, you know, there are societal benefits to the investment in higher education. On the regional economic side, I believe that the evidence is more emergent, but there is significant evidence that shows that metropolitan regions that have higher educational attainment do better in economic downturns and recover faster after economic downturns. And it is true that, you know, at the state level, and I was actually a state economic development official for 4 years, so I've lived this reality. You know, there is this notion that firms increasingly, so, you know, in that game of business attraction, which the economic literature is mixed on, there's definitely, you know, experientially, more and more firms are saying that it matters that there's an educated population where they're moving their operations if they're looking at you. So I think there is regional economic data that suggests that the income growth and productivity growth in regions with more educated folks do better, and they also recover faster after an economic downturn. And also, I'll add to that just this experiential notion from my time as an economic development practitioner, that I did experience that where firms seem less and less interested in the tax credit I could give them for the building and more interested in knowing the level of education of the folks that were going to be in their immediate workforce pool.
Professor Vetter, do you want to have the last word on that? Because we're coming to a close here, unfortunately.
There's all kind of evidence we could cite. I run regression equations where I look at the relationship between state appropriations on universities and economic growth in general, and I get negative relationships. The state that spend more get less growth. Now, that data is – I cannot in 1 minute begin to discuss the ramification of that. So I think that the evidence is mixed on this. But and by the way, I'm a strong believer in universities. But as Lewis said at the beginning, I think some people, the best education for a person varies dramatically from individual to individual. And some are better going to apprentice programs. Some are better going to learn to trades. And maybe a 1- and 2-year non-degree certificated programs. And we need to put more attention onto these non-traditional forms of education.
That's all the time we have. You know, as someone who was told in high school that she wasn't college material, I just want to thank you for having such a wonderful conversation with me today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. My guests, Richard Vetter, Ohio State University economics professor, and Luis Suarez, Center for American Progress, director of their post-secondary education program. We are out of time now. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Marburn Academy, a forward-thinking school for ADHD and dyslexic students, inviting you to a parent seminar on understanding the problems of ADHD children, Tuesday, June 15th at 7 p.m. More at marburnacademy.org.